Here we go. Okay, there we go. So the Gemara brings us a sort of summary, but it's in the mouth of Rava. Remember, Rava is an Amora who lives in Babylonia. So Rava concludes Hilchata. The law is, this is 50b3 in English, Hilchata, the law, as far as the subject goes of Ona'ah, is as follows. Pachot mishtut nikne mekach. If there is Ona'ah of less than a sixth, then the sale is valid, or the mekach is the sale, what you're buying, nikna. It is acquired. It is acquired. So keep in mind that that's not necessarily obvious, because what we are saying is that there either there's justification or there is a certain circumstance where even if you are overpaying or underpaying, you might theoretically say that all overpaying or all underpaying should be prohibited by the law in some way. But we see that that's not the case, that there's a threshold. The threshold is a sixth. If you don't reach that threshold, then nikna mekach. In fact, the sale is a sale. Yoter al shtut, more than a sixth, more than a sixth, bitul mekach. Bitul mekach. That is to say that, as I wrote it up there in my diagram, this is Rava's summary. Right? More than a sixth, it's no deal. So less than a sixth, it's a done deal. More than a sixth, it's no deal. Okay? Shtut, when we hit exactly a sixth, kana, it is a deal, but you have to return the excess amount. Now, have to return the excess amount, that means the whole sixth. The whole sixth has to be returned. And in both cases, where there is either no deal, or there is a deal, but you have to return the excess, what you shouldn't have really had, in both those cases there's a time limit. In both cases, there's a time limit, and the time limit is the that you have to be able to, what does it say there? No. Merchant or relative. That's correct. That's the time limit, is the amount of time it will take to show it to a merchant or a relative. Okay? Now, what the Gemara will regularly do is, if you have a teaching of an Amora, it will be strengthened enormously if you can show that there is a Baraita that takes the same point of view. Baraita dates from the time of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the year 200 or before. Baraita means outside of. It was left outside of the Mishnah. Outside of the Mishnah. So here we have a Baraita. Tanya te gavate de Rava. Tanya, it was taught in a Baraita as Rava. In the following way. Ona'ah pachot mishtut. Where you have a ona'ah that is less than a sixth, nikne mekach. Okay? The deal is a deal. The sale is valid. Yater al shtut patel mekach. When it is more than a sixth, the sale is void. Shtut, when it is just a sixth, machzir ona'ah. Machzir ona'ah, you have to, it's a deal, but you have to return the excess amount that shouldn't have been coming your way. Okay? And that's Divrei Rabbi Natan. So, Rabbi Natan has the same point of view as Rava. Has the same point of view as Rava. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi Omer, but here's the rest of the Baraita. The Baraita is not all in support of the point of view of Rava. There's another point of view, which is in the name of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. Now, that's not insignificant, because Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was the editor of the Mishnah. So one might think that the editor of the Mishnah would have a key role to play in the making of the law. In fact, it doesn't look that way. At least at this stage of the game, it doesn't look that way. So Rabbi Yehuda Nasi Omer, he says the following, Yad Mocher Al Ha'Elyona. Now here it's shorthand. At least the commentators understand this to be shorthand. Yad Mocher, that is to say, if the seller was the defrauded party. So here it mentions Mocher, the seller. So in a case where the seller was the defrauded party, okay, Yad Mocher Ala Elyona. His hand, he has the upper hand. Yado Ala Elyona. Rotze, and here he shows you what he means. He makes it very articulate. Rotze Omer lo ten li mikachi. If he wants, he may say to the buyer, give me my merchandise. O ten li mashe initani. Or give me what you have defrauded me. Alright? So, in other words, in both the cases here, where there is some problem, where there is a real ona'ah, either where it's greater than a sixth, or the case of the 1/6, in fact, the party that suffers can decide what to do about it. The party that suffers decides, there are a variety of possibilities here. He could decide that he doesn't care. That's one possibility. Since he is the defrauded party, it's within his prerogative to do that. He can decide to cancel the whole transaction. Or he can decide to keep the transaction and to get back the money that he's owed. So these are two really very different possibilities here. Both of them now are more or less contemporaneous. They are both in the time of the Mishnah. One is in the name of Rabbi Judah the Prince. The other is in the name of Rabbi Natan. But the key thing is that Rava goes according to Rabbi Natan and not according to Rabbi Judah the Prince. See? Okay. Any questions so far? Yes.
if the wrong party says, listen, the deal is off unless you make up the difference, call it square, is essentially nullifying the original transaction and then doing the second transaction of what both parties
want. Well, wouldn't he consider that though? Because if he's saying the deal is off unless, then in fact it's not a question of redoing the transaction. The transaction is done. There is simply one person owes the other party something, which is the ona'a. Okay? That's the way we will be conceived. Okay? Okay, now the Gemara goes on to focus a little bit more on our Mishnah. Ad matai mutar lachsir. That we had in the Mishnah, you remember? We've seen it several times. Till when is it permissible to lachsir? Now, I don't know exactly what lachsir means, because what I have up there, you see, in two situations, it is relevant to show it to a merchant or to a relative. And lachzir can mean two different things. Lachzir literally means to return. To return. But that doesn't really help me, because it can mean two different things. To return could mean to return the goods and to cancel the whole transaction. Or to return could mean to return a certain amount of money that was more than what you should have paid. So, I don't really know what that means. It could go either way, depending upon, well, even Rabbi Natan and Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. Okay? It's not clear. Ad matai mutar lachzir. So, let's just deal with the time involved. Amar Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman says, Lo shanu ela lokeach. We have learned this time only in regard to a defrauded buyer. A defrauded buyer. Aval mocher li olam choser. But a defrauded seller can return it forever. Oh, we didn't know that. I never can imagine that. I never imagined that there could be a difference. I assumed that the buyer and the seller, no matter who had done wrong, the time limit that we're talking about applies to both of them. But now, according to the Gemara, where the Mishnah talks about returning, it doesn't necessarily mean both of them. It only means one of them. It only means one of them. And in fact, the one that it's talking about is the buyer, where the buyer has been defrauded. Not that there's less of a problem with the seller. In fact, the seller has an unlimited time to collect what he's been defrauded. Now, that seems very strange, because we didn't expect that at all.
Not strange at all.
No.
Well, the seller has the goods. He could always sell it to somebody else.
Very good. That's what Rashi says. Okay. Well, wait a minute. No, it's the opposite.
Yeah.
It's the opposite. You're close, but it's the opposite. Because if you sell it to a buyer, and the buyer has overpaid, who's got the goods?
Buyer.
The buyer has the goods, correct. So the buyer is in the position of being able to show this to somebody else. Because remember, the time limit was dependent upon him showing something. The reality is, what does the seller have to show? He has nothing to show. He's already sold it. So in effect, he's in a far more disadvantageous position because he no longer has the goods. So in fact, now according to Rav Nachman, there is no time limitation on his part. The only one we can put a time limitation on is the buyer, because the buyer, in effect, has the goods. He can show it to somebody else. It's much more difficult. The seller is in a disadvantageous position since he doesn't have the goods. Right?
I think the seller, there's no responsibility on the part of the seller to set a price that's...
No, it's every responsibility. But the question is, if the seller has himself been defrauded, right? The seller sells for too little money.
But whose fault is that?
That's the question here. Now, we're not saying that he has no recourse. He has recourse. He has plenty of recourse, at least according to Rav Nachman here. I'm not going to answer this in any final way, because the Gemara will ask you a question also. Okay? Because you might assume the seller is in a different position from the buyer. But at least at this stage, in terms of Rav Nachman's interest, according to Rashi, the way Rashi understands this, the key issue is that there's a fundamental difference between the ability of the buyer and the seller to be able to show the goods to somebody else. And therefore, the buyer is in a better position than the seller is, and therefore the seller shouldn't be subject to the same time limitations as is the buyer. That's all. We're not saying he doesn't have rights. He has plenty of rights. Matter of fact, he can exercise those rights, the seller can, for a longer period of time, simply because he doesn't have the goods.
Shouldn't he have set the price by showing it to somebody before he sold it to figure out what the price
was? Well, maybe he didn't. You're right. But are we going to penalize him for that? You might say we're going to penalize him, but then you would be putting the buyer and the seller in a different position in terms of what we are assuming they have to know. Because remember, the Torah is protecting both of them.
Rabbi, I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Do the transactions here have to involve material objects? That is to say, you know, now we talk about sale of ideas, for example, in which case the buyer and the seller would presumably, there's not an object that moves.
Correct. The assumption here is that they are talking about objects. And that's partly behind the argument of Rav Nachman, that in fact there has to be something that you can show. The commentators revise Rav Nachman's view in the following way. Let me see whether somewhere here there was a good comment. No. The commentators revise the view of Rav Nachman in the following way. They say that if, however, the seller will encounter a similar object in the course of his business, either he is selling it, or more likely, somebody else. another merchant or another relative is selling a similar object, and therefore he has a context for being able to point to the object, to look at the object, and to see what the object is selling for, in that case, from that point on, his time limit is run out. Right? That fixes the end of his time limit. Since the time limit is dependent entirely on the presence, so Rav Nachman says, of the goods, if the goods should materialize, not even exactly the same goods, but similar goods, we hold the buyer the seller responsible at that point for being able to put the two and two together, for being able to ask someone else, and after that time he has no recourse anymore. Right? So it's not as absolute as it seems here in the Gemara. The commentators modify that. No, they modify it logically.
Footnote 22.
Very good. So footnote 22 is correct.
Can we put that in the context of a term I see in the paper a lot, which is buyer's remorse.
Buyer's remorse. What does that mean?
I mean, somebody is looking for a house. He sees a place he likes. Price is okay. Makes a bid. It's accepted. He buys the house. Now he thinks he overpaid because the person bought it. He's suffering because he's living in the house and he sees it every day. So I don't think the term seller is remorse. The seller moved to California.
Uh-huh. So the seller doesn't have remorse.
The buyer, 10 years later, is still angry that he... So you have to live with him. Now, if the seller moved next door, uh-huh. And the market went up, well, he suddenly realized...
The seller's remorse.
He would have
a seller's remorse.
So then you have to limit both.
Okay. All right, that's mutatis mutandis, right? You're making a reverse situation. Yes.
Before I talked about two very different situations with regard to the seller. One is where the seller just doesn't understand the market he's in terms of the appropriate price within that market. The other was where the seller has no appreciation of the value of the item because he simply doesn't have the capacity to appreciate the intrinsic value of the item. And in another market, that item is exceedingly precious. We talked about the Torah scrolls. So those seem to me very different ways in which the seller is quote-unquote defrauded. In the first, it's really the seller's lack of due diligence within an accepted marketplace. In the other, the seller really just has no shot at really understanding.
Correct.
So those seem to me...
They are different, and I think that it is in your first case that we're really talking about here. Because this is where there is a presumption of an existing market, that people are participating in that market. And I think there are really two sides to this. One is the protection of the buyer and the seller. The end result, however, is the protection of the market. It really, by protecting the buyer and the seller, what you are doing is creating the ideal situation to have a functioning market and to allow people to participate in that market on an even playing field. Correct, with confidence. Because otherwise they're not confident in the market.
It's all trust.
Correct. And in a way, you're regulating certain behavior in order to maximize trust. And that's a crucial issue in all markets. And it's a major issue that we're living through right now still. Is when you've lost trust, how do you reestablish trust?
I think this is a very, very sophisticated, just amazing that we're thinking about this at this time. Recognize the difference between the market price and the selling price, okay? Because mm-hmm. they shouldn't be. In classical economics, they're one and the same. The reason that they're different, okay, here and in other places, is because there's a lack of information in terms of one party or another, and that's just what the SEC is supposed to be here to protect us against.
Yes. Okay.
You should show this to them.
Yes.
What I missed here is the reason for the sale, because it is not always a question of profit or loss.
That's correct. And the Gemara is going to get to that. So hold your horses for just another few minutes. Because indeed there may be certain conditions where there are special reasons for a sale. And therefore, let's say the seller might want to sell at above a market price, let's say, and the question is whether that should be tolerated. There may be odd conditions, and we'll have to see what some of those are. Okay? Let's keep going. Okay, so Rav Nachman says, Lo shanu el lokeach. Again, this is Rav Nachman's position. The Mishnah is taught only vis-a-vis, that is to say, the time limits to have a repair to the situation of defrauding, which has time limits. That is only in the case of the buyer, but the seller can return it forever. Right? Now, this is brought for a purpose. Not really to teach us what we've just been saying, but Nema Mesaile, can we say that the Mishnah supports Rav Nachman? At the Mishnah itself, the Gemara is now going to set up a hypothetical. The hypothetical is that if you look at our Mishnah supports this point of view of Rav Nachman. Now, tell you the truth, when I read the Mishnah, I didn't see it that way. Never thought of that. So how could it be that the Gemara itself says that the Mishnah supports Rav Nachman? Right? It will articulate it. Chazru l'divrei chachamim. You remember that the merchants in Lod, they didn't like what had happened. Remember the story of the merchants in Lod? Let's go back and read the Mishnah for a moment. Where is that Mishnah? What page is it? What's that? 49b2. Okay, so let's read that. Hora Rabbi Tarfon b'Lod, Rabbi Tarfon taught in Lod, ha'ona ashmona kesef mi esrim va'arba'a kesef l'sela. Ona consists of 8 out of 24. That is to say, the fraud has to be one-third and not one-sixth. One-third and not one-sixth. So, then it goes on, Samchu Tagarelot. So the merchants of Lod were very happy with that point of view. Okay. Amar Lahem, Rabbi Tarfon then says to him, Kol Hayom Mutar Lachzor. But there isn't a short amount of time that the buyer can come back to the merchant. There's a long period of time. Here it says, all day. Amru Lo. They said to him, Yaniach lanu Rabbi Tarfon bimkomenu, forget it, Rabbi Tarfon, leave us where we were before, v'chazru d'divrei chachamim. And they went back to the point of view of the sages. Right? So just keep that in mind. Now let's see the way the Gemara is trying to build this argument. Neim mesayle chazru d'divrei chachamim. That phrase in the Mishnah, that the merchants of Lod decided to go back to the point of view of the rabbis, can we say that this is a support for Rav Nachman's view, which says that in fact the merchants have no limit? How would this be? I am not bishlama mocher liolam chazer. This, you might say, it is well if you say, Bishlama, okay, Mocher liolam chozer. This, the fact that they went back to the rabbi's position, makes sense if liolam chozer, normally they would have forever. They would have forever.
Question.
Wait, don't ask yet. You got to keep going. Because we're right in the middle of the argument. We can stop in the middle of the argument, we'll never see the end of it. Okay? Mishum hachi chazru. Because of that, they went back to the position of the rabbis. That is to say, they liked the idea that they should be able to have an infinite amount of time. What they didn't like was the fact that the buyer was the one who was getting more time. The buyer was getting more time. Ela iamrat. But if you say, Mocher na mikolokeach dame, If you say that the seller was in the same position as the buyer, my nafka lahomina, what did it matter to them? What difference did it make to them? Namely, according to Rabbi Tarfon, the amount of time was expanded to a whole day. Okay? The amount of time was expanded to a whole day. And we see as a result of expanding the time from a short time to a long time, the merchants are upset. So the Gemara says, well, why would they be upset? Because they're also beneficiaries from this expansion of time. Right? If expanding the time means both the buyer and the seller, the buyer has something to gain. And in all truth, the seller has something to gain. Because now he can worry about all day. He can wait until, you know, to see whether in fact he has sold for too little. So he has something to gain as the buyer has something to gain. However, if in fact they're operating on two different planes, namely the seller never had to worry because none of this applies to the seller in the first place, and it only applies to the buyer. Now, when we expand the prerogative of the buyer from a short time to a long time, the merchant doesn't at all want that, because he has nothing to gain and everything to lose. Okay? So that's how the Gemara goes. The Gemara says, as a result of that, the fact that they turned around and they went back to the position of the rabbis shows that they couldn't have been on the equal foot. That both the buyer and the seller couldn't have been in the same position. It was only the buyer that was in a better position. Okay? So it goes on a little bit further. This is what we said. What difference would it make then to the seller? That's what I just said. Ki hechi da'av de la rabbanan takanta la lokeya. Just as according to Rabbi Tarfon, the rabbis made an improvement for the buyer by extending the time limit. Similarly, the rabbis made an improvement for the seller. Okay? So the Gemara doesn't like the argument. It's not a bad argument. But the Gemara says the following. Tagare lo lo shachiach tatal. For the fact is that they were both in the same position. They were both in the same position, but there was a big difference between the buyer and the seller. Namely, the merchants of Lod were very smart. And so it doesn't matter to them that their amount of time is small or less. It doesn't matter to them. That's irrelevant to them because they know what they're doing. What matters to them is that the buyer, who doesn't know as much as they know, that the buyer's timeline should be expanded. Right? They don't make mistakes, these merchants. They don't make mistakes. Buyers make mistakes all the time. And therefore, they don't want the buyer to have any additional benefit. Okay? The conclusion of this, therefore, is that the Mishnah, in fact, doesn't support Rav Nachman. Okay? See, this is the way the Gemara works. The Gemara sets up hypothetical. Can we say that the Mishnah supports Rav Nachman? And interestingly enough, as a result of the fact that eventually we decide, no, it doesn't. We end up where we started out. Now the Gemara, in fact, is telling us that what we originally thought was correct. But still, on the way, you learn more and more about the difference between the buyer and the seller. And we also learn that, certainly as far as the sellers of Lod were concerned, they were very sharp. They were very sharp.
Does this suggest that even this, the equal conditions benefit the buyer more because the seller, that means that the buyer is always in a position, is always in a sort of more vulnerable position?
Well, the Gemara doesn't exactly say that, but I think you're probably right. The Gemara says that as far as the merchants of Lod are concerned, indeed, in that case, the merchants are in a much better position.
Even though the conditions that apply to them are equal, those same conditions benefit the buyer
more than the seller. Correct.
Well, that can only be because the buyer needs those things. You know, needs
exactly
that
right.
Help.
Exactly. Okay.
Well, back to the difference. You can easily imagine a very sophisticated buyer, like the pawn shop.
Right.
So it seems to me that the detection really functionally should be with the less experienced, whether they're the buyer or the seller.
Mm-hmm.
There's really the need for the building of the trust.
In which case, you might assume that it should be the same on both sides, that Rav Nachman's position of allowing... Well, that's actually another issue, because that was the presence of the object. In fact, the buyer and the seller are in a different position because the buyer has the object, the seller doesn't have the object. But in fact, both there are needs for protection for both. Because that's the way the Torah sets it up in the first place, and there must be some reason for that. Wait, no, Meir is next. Meir was before.
No, I just noted that Tagarei Lod, they seem to have a mind of their own and in a position to decide which opinion to take.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of caught my attention. Maybe mm-hmm. they had a special status or something.
Well,
it's like the rabbis are saying this and that and the different opinions, and the people decide which opinion to go by.
You can learn a few things from that. Number one, that during the time that we're reading about, namely the time of the Mishnah, there were differences of opinion. And that different rabbis had differences of opinion in the interpretation of the law. And in fact, in different places, they were subject to different rabbis. And the rabbis of the places had the right to adjudicate according to their opinions. The variety of opinions, as well as the variety of places, becomes very much diminished over time. Over time. Intuitively, we might think that over time, you get more opinions. But in a legal system, it actually functions the opposite way. That there are a very unusual set of conditions which allow for variety. But in a legal system, what tends to happen is that conformity substitutes for variety. Because you want to have a universal system that really works, where everybody agrees. Because in fact, it's you being used in a functioning society. And if you have a whole variety of different views, then the merchants in Lod won't be able to do business with the merchants in Yerushalayim. Though that may not matter all the time, it may matter more and more over time. And in fact, that's what eventually happens. So you are getting an insight into a particular time in the development of a law when there is much more variety than later on there is. Okay? And you can see it in its give and take as it's the ideas are being fleshed out. There was another... yes, sir.
The biblical sentence says, Al tonu ish et re'ehu, which I understand is equal protection to both.
Correct.
Where in the Bible or in the development of the common practice, there is an indication that shows that the protection shouldn't be even, that one will be...
Well, wait, because the Gemara is going to discuss that. Okay? The Gemara will discuss exactly this. Okay? Or, if it doesn't, tell me then, because it's going to wonder about that question. There was another hand. Yes?
It's a pickup on the same question. You have the merchants of Lod, they go according to the sages. Procedurally, if they're in Rabbi Tarfon's jurisdiction, they can, and they hold before Rabbi Tarfon, they can say, well, we're following the sages.
That's an interesting point. You're right. Another piece of the dynamic here is that the rabbis don't make all the decisions, believe it or not. The rabbis make some of the decisions. And you can see that the reality of circumstances really forces decisions in a certain direction. We tend to think of the development of a law as being driven by the masters of a law. It's only sort of true. Reality is the force of circumstance drives the development of a law as much as the masters of a law. And I suppose that's probably true in business in general. Probably a lot of what goes on, let's say, you know, that we think of as being driven by the legal system, let's say now in terms of banking law. And I think a lot has to do with, in fact, what goes on, what it takes to run a bank. And can legislators really know what it takes to run a bank? Can they run banks better than bankers can?
This is our first lobbyist. Everyone can run. Correct. The merchants are one of the first special interests of
the Yes. In a manner of speaking. Okay?
We had something similar when we were studying Kira, and I don't remember the specific circumstance, but one of the Moraine and I disputed and said, look, if I go back to my people and tell them you can't do this, they'll say, okay, we're getting a different rabbi.
This is true. It's very true.
Bathhouse in
it was men with their nocturnal emissions, and it was whether they had to go to the mikvah or not.
That's also, but I know it's the same thing. That goes back
that
to Brachot. But that was also, well, I don't know all of us.
But
I don't think Rob was in the class at that time.
Right.
But that's another example. Occasionally the law is, if not determined, at least profoundly affected. Its development is hand in hand with the people who are affected by the law. Okay? Let's keep going. Ushbezichne, derami parchama zabin chamra v'ta'a. Now, the word I want to just point out, this Aramaic word, ushbezichne. Where did you ever see that word before? Ushbezin, very good.
The visitors and guests.
Guests, correct. Well, depends. It's got a nun in the end here. This is not ushpizin, this is ushpizichan. As you know in Hebrew, too, you can add a nun to a word and it can turn the word around entirely. So this is the landlord, ushpizin, the guests in the sukkah are called ushpizin, right? This is a word that's similar but not the same. The landlord of Rami Bar Chama, Zabin Chamra Vata'a, sold wine and erred by undercharging. That's the assumption here. Okay? So he was a landlord and he sold wine and he got too little for it.
Steinzel says Chamor, like a donkey.
Oh, no, I don't think it... I think...
Chamra is the name.
Chamor in Hebrew is donkey. Chamra in Aramaic means
red.
Wine.
Because
it's red. Well, it's Aramaic for wine.
For the red color.
Okay.
But
Steinzel
says
Chamor. It's perfectly possible. Yeah. Perfectly possible. Okay. Ashkechei dahava atziv. Okay, Rami comes and he sees his landlord, and the landlord is sad. Atziv, atzuf. He's upset. Amale, he says to him, Amai atzivat. Why are you upset? Amale, Zabini chamra vitai. I sold wine and I erred. I made a mistake. Amale, zil hadarbach. Then go and reverse yourself. Hadarbach, cancel the sale. Cancel the sale. The assumption being here that he's making the assumption that it was greater than a sixth. It was greater than a sixth. And of course, it's not to be assumed that the landlord knew the law. The rabbi knows the law. The landlord is just upset. So the rabbi says to him, you have recourse. You have recourse. Armele ha shahaili yoter michidei sha'are letagar ulikrovi. He says, no, I do know the law. But the problem is that I've waited longer than I'm allowed to, because I've waited longer than it takes to show the merchandise to a relative or to a merchant. Shadre l'kamid Rav Nachman. Oh, so he sends this now, he sends the legal question, because Rami knows the point of view of Rav Nachman. Remember, the point of view of Rav Nachman is that a seller is never subject to the time limit. So he's smart enough to say, look, we'll send the case now to Rav Nachman. I know that Rav Nachman's, according to Rav Nachman, there is no time limit for the seller. Okay? So Shadri, the Kameder Rav Nachman, Amalei, Lo Shanu Ela Lokeach. Rav Nachman then says, and that this the time limit applies only to the buyer, only to the buyer. Aval mocher liolam chozer, but a defrauded seller can always retract. Okay, so here the law, we see that the law is functioning the way that we saw Rav Nachman interpreted it. It's in his jurisdiction, so we see an application of his interpretation of the law. Did I see another hand? Yes.
I just sort of wonder why this little story would be in here, because Nachman has already said that's what the law is, and it seems like the story is saying no more than what he said with the statement.
I think the Gemara probably has it here because the point of view is not at all intuitive. Rav Nachman's point of view is not intuitive. It's not necessarily intuitive that there should be a difference in the time limits between the buyer and the seller. So in order to show that there is support for such a point of view, we have stories.
But it's the same, it's also
not adding anything, you're right.
I mean, it's also Nachman just saying in his story what he's earlier said in the Gemara.
Okay, that's correct. That's correct.
The question is, why you need that story?
You don't need it.
The wine and become a different people.
You don't need the story. You don't need the story, but I think in the context of the introduction of this idea, and I'm arguing because it's not an intuitive idea, I think intuitively they should be both expected to have the same time limits. I think the Gemara simply brings further support. And that's not the only story. There's another story here. There's another story that follows, which makes the same point. Look what happens next. Well, first the Gemara explains. My Tama, what's the reason? I'm sorry. In fact, this is the answer to your question. Because in fact, however, I explained it according to Rashi, why there would be a difference in the time limits for the buyer and for the seller, the Gemara never said that. And at this point now, the Gemara uses the occasion of the story to further flesh out and to ask, why would there be a difference between the two? See what it says. Maitama, what is the reason that there's a difference between the time limits of the seller and the buyer? Lokeach mikachol biyado. The buyer has his purchase in his hand. Kol hecha da'azil machfelei. Wherever he goes, he can show that purchase to someone else. And people will say to him whether he has erred or he has not erred. But the seller, on the other hand, who doesn't take the purchase around with him, until he encounters an item for sale like the one that he sold, the yada iyada ita'a, and at that point he will know whether he has erred, the ilota'a, or whether he has not erred. That is why there is a difference between the two of them. So in fact the story came in order to just bring us really to this further discussion, which is what is the reasoning behind Rav Nachman's view.
I don't agree with that, and I'll tell you why. The seller had the merchandise for 6 years before he sold it. He could play the game with anybody in the universe to study if the price is right or not, and then sell it. So the argument that the seller didn't have enough time to establish a price, but only after he sold it, it's not correct, because...
You are undoubtedly correct that there are sellers who would do exactly as you said. But what if there are sellers who didn't do that way?
So they should pay the price?
Why?
Fire sale.
Why? Why? Why should they pay the price? Why should the seller be in a less...
Why to put a limit on the buyer? If you don't want the seller to pay the price of his own mistake...
Yeah, you may be right. I'm not telling you that Rav Nachman is right. I'm not telling you that Rav Nachman is right. I'm telling you the reasoning of Rav Nachman.
No, I understand, but okay. The same reason should be a pre-existing condition to the reason. If you limit the buyer because of lack of knowledge, because now he has the merchandise to show around for a day, you can say that if the seller had the merchandise for a day, he cannot recourse. He cannot ask back the buyer for his money or merchandise.
You may be right.
It should be even. It cannot be that the guy had it for 6 years and only after he made his sale.
You don't like the argument of the Gemara? The Gemara says there is a material difference between the position of both of them. One, and it is simply the possession of the object. The seller no longer has an object.
But he had it before.
But he doesn't have it in it. You may be in this one case, but what if he did have it for an unlimited time? What if he had it for a short time? And he was buying a whole quantity of goods. And he didn't look over the... You know, he quickly looked at all the goods that he had. He didn't look it over
so
carefully.
So he was a buyer, so he has another seller in line.
No, but he then turns into a buyer. I mean, sorry, he then turns into a seller.
No, it's like ganav mi ganav gamur.
No. You have thought of a case where this wouldn't be true. I'm just saying there's a case where it would be true. That's all. There may be even a lot of cases. And behind this, you realize... is the law of the Torah. The fact is that the Torah comes, and the Torah comes and it puts them both in the same position. Torah says, you shall not, neither the buyer nor the seller should wrong one another. Right? We have to contend with that. We've got to deal with that fact. Yes?
I have a question. I understand why the rabbis might try and set theoretical limits on overreaching in value, if you could know a real value. But the time doesn't make sense to me, because doesn't the value, how can you apply a single time limit to all objects? Because many objects deteriorate. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you drink the wine, corn would rot. Mm-hmm. Gold does not rot. So how could you, even in theory, have a universal time that you would apply as a rule to all of these exchanges, whether you apply that to the seller or the buyer or mm-hmm. both?
I would imagine the reason that you would have a universal time is to keep the economy functioning. It's to give, if everything were different for every different object, mm-hmm. which is not to say there may not be a few special cases, I'm not saying it has to be the case in all cases, but I think that the thrust of the law is to get one standard, because otherwise it'll be very difficult to have commerce. And therefore it tries to achieve a common amount of time, whatever that is. It may be that the most common time is going to be a compromise time. Because you're right, different things are different. There's no doubt about that. So we may have to have a compromise, but the thrust of it, I think, will be to find some commonly acceptable standard that works as far as time goes.
Because I think the fraction you could apply, at least in theory, to anything. Mm-hmm. The fraction of the value, even if you can't know that value.
Okay.
But the time, you know, a horse would get older if you bought a horse.
Right.
Or a donkey. I have trouble even just with trying to.
But if you're limiting the time, as the time is limited here, to a relatively short period of time, right? It's relatively short. Either it's the amount of time that it takes to see another merchant. It's less than a day, that I can tell you, because these merchants of Lod rejected that. That was much too long a time. So it's a, given these things, it's relatively short. And I would imagine that it's applying to most objects. Did you have your hand up? No? Yes.
If the seller has an infinite amount of time, doesn't the system assume that the value of an object remains stable over time? It doesn't change.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, you're right. I mean, at a certain point, the market changes.
Right.
There's no doubt about that. So,
like in 6 years, an object might be worth more, and then you can come back to the buyer and say, well...
No, he couldn't do that, though, because he would have to... The only thing he could prove is when he made the sale.
Okay, so he'd have to...
It would have to relate to the time when the sale was actually done, not to the new sale price, the new market price, 6 years later.
Right, that would be pretty difficult to do.
Correct. So the reality is that it's not as advantageous as it seems. At least for that reason... The major reason why it's not as advantageous as it seems is what the Gemara itself said about the Tagare Lot. Merchants know what they're doing. Okay? I mean, the reality is that the merchants really know what they're doing. The real need here is to protect the buyer, not the seller. But you have to create the argument in terms of both of them because the Torah tries to protect both.
Not that I'm favoring it, because you'll see that I don't, but you could always monetize value later on. So even if whatever it is has deteriorated there, you can, if you have money, always monetize it. But any delay is really bad for the market. Because the truth is, if I purchase something and I have to wait a day to know whether or not I can use it, I'm not really enjoying that possession in a very meaningful way. Because if I need that possession in order to do something else, I'm now frozen, or I'm taking a really big risk if I do something to that to convert it into something else that I can't then give back. And if I have an infinite amount of time, then that's really lethal in terms of the psychology of the market. It may be good Torah.
And it's not going to work that way in the market. The Gemara is presuming that, in fact, that's not what's going to happen. Because you're right. You can't have that infinite amount of time. Again, I think the issue is that, at least from Rav Nachman's point of view, that the merchants won't need it. The seller really doesn't need that. Okay? Let's keep going. Because you're not going to see a slightly different case. Hahu gavre davenakad var shechel azabune. Okay, there was a man who had silk ribbons for sale. He had silk ribbons. Now, he's listed, by the way, as a gavre. This is important. He's listed as a gavre. The subtlety of the Aramaic is, if you call a person a man, he's a regular person. What is that to be compared to? A merchant. He is not spoken of as a merchant. He is spoken of as a man, as a person. Kare shita v'sham v'chamsha. He called out 6 zoos as his price, but they were actually worth only 5. Okay? So they were worth 5, and he called out 6. Okay? Now remember, this was our last class, we talked about, you know, what do we use the selling price, or do we use the market price for the 6th? You can see in this case, it's 1/6 at least. If it were the market price, it would be more than 1/6. All right, more than 1/6. The ihavu yahavele chamisha ufalga. But were they to give him 5.5, havashakil, he'd be willing to take 5.5. All right, so it's worth 5. He calls out 6. He wants to sell it for 6, but he's willing to take 5.5. So that's the way he's going into this. Another man comes and he says, Iyahiv nalecham she'afalga. If I offer this guy who wants to sell the 6, 5.5, alright? Hava mechila. That's less than a sixth over what it's worth. Alright? So I'll have to pay 5.5. Right? So I have no recourse. Because he knows the market, this guy. Eten leshita, but if I give him 6, the itbe ledina, I'll take him to court afterwards. So in other words, he can get it for a better price if he offers more than if he offers less.
If he's willing to go to court.
All right. Well, in those days, it's not so complicated. The local rabbi goes to the local rabbi. You end up to pay a lawyer. Correct. Right? It's a small. There's a small claims kind of court. Okay. It be ledina. So he does that. He pays him 6, and now he goes to court. Ata lekame de Rava. He comes in front of Rava. Amar le, Rava says to him, Lo shanu ele lokech min atagar. When we have the law of overreaching. This applies only in the case of buying from a merchant. All right? But if you purchase something from a balabayit, from a just a normal person, literally a balabayit is a house owner, it's just a regular person, ein lo alav ona'a, the laws of ona'a do not apply. The laws of Onah, very interesting, the laws of Onah did not apply. Now, let's take a look at the reason for this. Let's see, I think, take a look at number 7 in the notes. It's a good note. The Gemara explains below that a householder considers his personal effects, such as jewelry and household implements, dear to him, and hence sells them for more than their actual worth. Interesting idea. The things that you own personally, you relate to them not as a merchant would, because you're invested in them. They're yours. They have your own personal history. Okay? And when you sell them, therefore, we do not assume that you want to sell them at the market price or that you have to sell them at the market price. Only a merchant is subject to the laws of the market. A person who is not a merchant, who's just selling something that he wants, that's a part of his personal effects, he can sell it for anything that he wants, because the buyer understands that also. The buyer knows when he's not buying from a professional, that he has to take into account that he may pay more than the market price. That's just the way it is when you buy from an individual. Of course, the other thing is that you may pay less. I mean, that's the other side of it. Paul, you're going to...
That certainly seems valid, but it doesn't seem to address what's most objectionable about this hypothetical situation, which is trying to manipulate the rule, which is really there to protect people who are at an informational disadvantage. But here it's really trying to manipulate that. And I would have thought that where this is going is that you're only entitled to that compensation if you really were at informational disadvantage. That you can't manipulate the system to try to make money.
Very good. You're very sensitive to the issue there. You know the way the Gemara deals with that? The person who tried to manipulate the system, what happened to him? He lost. He loses. That's the way the Gemara deals with this. When you have a story in the Gemara, in fact, the law itself will deal with a variety of circumstances. The rest are outside of the law, but you're going to lose. And the story will come to tell you that you lose. There's a whole issue here which will come up once in a while, which was the subject of the previous chapter, in Bam Metzia. And that involves a curse. It's called the Misha Para, Hey Resh Ayin, Misha Para. And the Misha Para is uttered in the following situation. A person does something he shouldn't have done, he takes advantage of somebody else. But we don't have any laws to that he can fall back on. You know, he's done it within the law. What do we do about a person? There is a curse that the Gemara suggests that you use. A curse is in English a little bit too strong. What it is he who paid back the people of Sodom is going to give you yours. You know, in other words, I'm trying to say it rather literally. So there are situations where, you know, we're dealing with a legal system. The law may or may not be effective simply because, you know, people may use it to their advantage inappropriately, in which case frequently you have something, either the Misha Parra, or in this case what happens is that the story itself shows that you lose, which means, and you only lose, of course, you get what you deserve. And that's a sort of a very simplistic but very biblical idea. The stories in the Bible work the same way. It doesn't matter who you are, if you're Joseph or if you're the whole stories of Rebecca, or if you're Jacob and Esau, you always get what you deserve. It may take time. It may not be immediately obvious. In the story itself, it looks like you don't get yet what you deserve. But if you look 2 weeks later, you get what you deserve. That's the way it always works. That's, I think, what happens here in the story. The force of that story is that the guy loses.
So for selling personal objects, I would have thought that there would be women who would have plots of gardening who would sell vegetables in a street market.
Mm-hmm.
And so what would they be considered merchants?
They would be considered merchants. They'd be considered merchants, correct. Because you could also engage in things that, you know, you could engage in your own personal stuff. You could trade your own portfolio, as it were. In which case, you're functioning as a merchant. You're subject to the laws of merchants. Okay, let's take another one. Hahu gavra, same thing now. A man comes, the havanakit kefe lezabune. He had, the English translation here is earrings. Rashi translates this as nizamim. Nizamim are nose rings. Right, that's the sensitivity of the yeshiva world. It doesn't want the yeshiva kids to stick stuff into their skin. But this is what the Rashi says is nose rings. How gavra da havanaki kefe lezabune. So this person had nose rings for sale. Kare shitin v'shavik hamshin. Right? He declared the price to be 60 zoos, and they're actually worth 50. So it's a similar story, but 10 times the amount. I havu yahave le hamshin v'chamsha. If I were to offer the guy 55, havashakil, he would take it. Right? He would take it because there's no recourse there. Ata hahu gavra va'amar. A man comes along and he says, the seller was willing to take 55. A man comes along and he says, if I give him 55, it's a done deal. It's a done deal. I lose, I have to pay 55. But if I give him 60, and I take him to court, then he'll get it for 50. They came before Rav Chista for a ruling. They have taught the rules for claiming a refund for overcharging only when buying from a merchant. But if you are making a purchase from a common person, the laws of ona'a do not apply. So I think what we learn from these two stories is something that's quite important as far as the laws of ona'a go. They do not apply to all transactions. They apply to transactions of a professional seller. Business. Real trade. You know, we all may engage in business from time to time, but there's a difference. Okay, let's go. And now, Amar le Radimi. Rav Dimi then says to Rav Chista, Yishar. Now, the phrase Yishar, by the way, you should know that phrase, because it's the short form of what we use, Yishar Koach. Yishar Koach, you can see it here in the Gemara. In other words, that's a good thing that you did. Yishar Koach, it's a good thing that you did. V'chein amar Rabbi Elazar, and likewise Rabbi Elazar said, Yishar. Okay, Yishar Koach. So the insight was worthwhile. Now the Gemara says, "Vaha anan tanan." But we have taught, we've learned in the Mishnah, "Kushem sha'ona ala hedyot." This is the next Mishnah. This is what we're going to read in just a moment. Just as there is ona'a for an ordinary person, kach ona'a letagar. So there is ona'a for a merchant. Man hedyot. What is the meaning of a common person? The Gemara itself says a common person. La bala bayit. Is that not referring to exactly the situation that we just learned about? Is it referring to a householder? Okay? So the Mishnah that's coming up seems to conflict with what we just learned. Amar Rav Chista, since we saw that one of these stories was in the name of Rav Chista, he says the following. Betzadraita, when the Mishnah is talking about the law is the same for all people, it's talking about, here it says, garments of hemp. Garments of hemp. Avalmane tashmishtei, but as far as garments of personal use, the yakreale, which are dear to him, lo mezabin laho ilav bidmei yetere. A person doesn't sell those things without expecting to earn more money from them. Now, let's take a look at this. First of all, the Aramaic. Rav Chista is the one who said this originally. It was Rav Chista who made this differentiation between the merchant and the balabayit. This case is now brought to Rav Chista. And Rav Chista explains that the Mishnah is not referring to the case he just adjudicated. Rather, it's referring to something else. It's referring to what's called here is betzadraita. Sadraita. Now, I want you to look in the Rashi. It's, in a way, almost just across the page. You have the Gemara in the middle of the page. The Rashi is immediately to the right of the Gemara on this page, because the Rashi is always on the side of the binding next to the Gemara. Go down about, an inch and a half in the Rashi, and you'll find in bold Hebrew letters, Bitsadraita. Bitsadraita. Do you find that? If you look down, you'll see.
It's the last one before the Mishnah.
Yes, that's right. It's the last one before it says Madnita. Bitsadraita. I just wanted you to see this, Rashi. Big day cannabis. That's what I want you to see here. Big day cannabis. So this is Rashi writing in classical Hebrew that this is referring to cannabis. All right? Now, cannabis, ha'omdim limaker, which are there to sell. Big day cannabis means, and the English is a fair translation for that, hemp. Hemp garments. Hemp garments are very cheap garments. The assumption is here that you're dealing with very common types of clothing. So, where a person is dealing with very common types of clothing, very common types of things, in fact, in those cases, the law of ona'ah does apply. The only cases where the law of ona'ah does not apply is where we can say that a person who is not a professional, not a regular merchant, has a special relation to what he is selling. And that usually means where it's something special. That's the way people are. They have things that are dear to them for personal reasons, just as there may be a lot of things that are not dear to them. Big day cannabis, hemp garments were, in their context, junk. They were not designer jeans. They were jeans the way they used to be when I grew up. When I grew up, jeans...
Like
it's like burlap. You're talking burlap. Who said dungarees? That's what we... In my day, we called them... My mother used to say, if you wear those dungarees, because it was considered to be such a low thing to do. I mean, there were places that I could wear it when I was rolling in the mud. That was what she wanted me to wear. But the idea that you could go to school, for example, in dungarees, you couldn't even say it. I mean, the language dungarees was a very low word. It has dung in it.
The dung
in it. Correct. So you couldn't even articulate it. It was such a low thing to think about. And then I read in the Wall Street Journal last week, my wife showed me the article about design, that today in the top boardrooms you have to have the special kinds of jeans. That it shows that you're really with it and that you're down to earth. But of course, they're not sloppy jeans. They're not too baggy. And they're not too tight. They have to be the right kind of jeans. You know. So there's a big difference. But they're talking about dungarees. burlap clothes, as you were saying. They're referring to things made of burlap. Burlap, you know, has... People don't relate to that in a personal way in their context. Okay? Any questions or comments? Then I think what we'll do, let's call it here, and we'll start with the Mishnah next time. It's a good start to be a good place to start. $50.